Chapter 6, Future's Fate in Time, Part 1. Recalcitrant in time, resigned to lives of grime, underwater smiling rise. Indeed, your Odyssey's your guise. Your listeners predicted your purposes to fix it. New tricks hit, the twin sick to death and fear to mix it. Dear Hops Hulk, cold, deep space fog, the deceased dog in Star's cock. Rejoice, my twins, your pain is zeal. Let it lead you to the real. You'll have to run or stay for none, out of the sun. But with a gun, have fun. This is your host, Red Grin. How many walls can you put up? How many scars till you feel sane? It feels like this evil won't let up. Is the future's past truly set? Ezra Dante August Theodore Hennessy slumped in the back seat of his father's brand new Ford Explorer. It was a car he didn't really want to be in, nor did he really want to be spending time with the man driving said car. But Ezra's father had been down since the divorce, and since he was actually married to his work, which may have been the problem, come to think of it, Alexander August didn't have many friends to fall back on during his lonely days, upon which colleagues were not an available option for company. That fucking office. That place had stolen him away from everyone. Those lonely days, Ezra thought, as he shifted uncomfortably in his father's new pride and joy, scratching at reopened wounds. The engine hummed as the car picked up speed towards the highway. They were heading for the family cabin, or lake house, situated on the outskirts of a town called Oswego County. To the north of the cabin you could see Lake Ontario, and it really was beautiful. An expanse of sparkling cobalt blue spanning just over 50 miles, bordered on the south by New York City and the Canadian province of Ontario to the north. The house itself was built for the Hennessy family some years previously, one of those timber-framed homes, designed, of course, by Ezra's mother and grandmother, paid for, mostly, by Ezra's father, one of the things he had managed to claim as his own during the separation, one that seemed never to end. The cabin had been the place where the Hennessy family could escape from the noise and the sometimes unwanted buzz of the big city. Amelia, Ezra's mother, worked long hours at the University Hospital over in Brooklyn. She was a surgeon and a doctor, and damn good at both, but between that and their father's fancy office job, which dealt with buying and selling shares in other companies on a street called Wall, Ezra and his twin sister Kaya had a hard time growing up. Their mother had jumped headfirst into med school as soon as she was able to dump the kids on her parents, already, according to her mother, having held a high-level job in the fashion business. After she fell pregnant, however, her manager refused to rehire nor pay her maternity leave. That wasn't a problem due to her husband's income, but over the course of the pregnancy, she decided she wanted to change career direction, given how cutthroat the business she was currently, or no longer currently involved with, had turned out to be. I need a job where I'm more than just necessary and replaceable. I need a job where I'm needed, Amelia had apparently announced to her mother. You already have that, honey. You're a mother now. Ezra had never been sure how that conversation had continued, but whatever Amelia had said after that had clearly been enough to convince her mother and father to take over full-time responsibility for her daughter's, at that point, 2-year-old children, and be in charge of them until Amelia obtained her doctorate in neurology. The twins got weekly visits from Amelia over her years at med school and weekends with their father, primarily at the lake house. And despite the incredibly close bond the twins had with their loving grandparents and each other, their upbringing had been one of extreme loneliness and despair, not least after the twins were diagnosed with their respective mental health disorders, which, given their mother's affinity and passion for neurology, had brought them closer together, when she was there at least, and made sure the twins received the best kind of medical care, especially when they were younger. Their father, however, the kind of man who believed you could remove or conjure any particular feeling with the use of drugs, effectively began to distance himself from his children in every way other than financially, which he believed was enough. Their mother disagreed, and as the twins grew and began to understand the world around them, one entirely based, to them anyway, on emotion, they also began to do the same, lashing out at their father. They both did it in their own ways, Kaya, in her adolescence, taking the more conventional route and developing similar substance dependencies to her father, much to her father's horror and worse, outer denial. Ezra, however, spent his time familiarizing himself with literature and the arts, publishing his first story when he was 13 years old, a science fiction piece called Lovecraftian Spires. A story which dealt with the questions like what reality is and how we can define what's real and what isn't. One of the points made in the story was that the landscapes we walk through while we dream the dreams we dream can be identified and defined more accurately than any stocks and shares in any company. And that the roads we walk have demons of air and darkness beneath. And that the people of this world can be far more certain of them than whether the stock of any particular company is going to go up, down, sideways, or in fucking circles. The darkness that hovers at the peripheries and the backs of our necks is enough to turn the most ordinary person into a cackling madman. That monsters are real. And that they can be seen, tracked on the elemental chart. But you know what can't be? Stocks and shares. Because they are not fucking real. To Ezra, the financial world and the heartlessness it encouraged was based on nothing more than a series of agreements that could collapse at any time. He raged against his father's professional way of life, stating almost daily through his work or his own words, Ezra wasn't sure if he was able to tell the difference anymore, that everything his father put his faith in wasn't real. They're more real than any of the characters in those comic books and novels you're so obsessed with, his father would say in retort, often while crumpling one of Ezra's latest published pieces in anger, or the most recently released issue of Batman, Superman, or Constantine. In the case of Ezra's published or as yet unpublished work, he would wave the typed manuscript or scribbled notes in his face and say something like, "What you're stating in here just isn't true. At least you can do things with money. See it, smell it, stack it, pay bills with it. Like you and your sister's goddamn Medicare overheads. Despite your mother's discount. Build things with it. Like this lake house. Where do you think this came from, huh? From too many trees and a lot of cocaine?" Ezra had replied as he exited the room. Ezra's mother had been present during the first of those arguments, even going as far as shouting his full name, in a way that parents do when the child is misbehaved, especially in social situations. There had been no malice behind it, though. No hint of future consequences. The first argument had been over Lovecraftian spires, and later a few more besides, and Ezra knew that argument number one, possibly number two when his father had thrown a wall-hanging wedding plate at his son, missing him by a few millimeters, was when she realized that the man she married seemed to be nothing more than a wild-eyed office drone she was beginning to totally despise. Thus, Amelia's mother and father, Arthur and Megan Hennessy, had done most of the work in the early spans of Kaya and Ezra's lives and often acted as regular refuge from their parents' collective neglect. Ezra's grandmother called him Dante, when she wasn't cross with him. It was her favorite of her grandson's many names, one that apparently she herself had suggested. Amelia had agreed on the condition that it could be one of many, as Amelia herself could never decide on a singular name. "We'll let him pick his favorite," she had apparently said, a few months before Ezra and Kaya had been born. Only a few minutes apart, Ezra came first, and he knew that Kaya had always slightly resented him for that. It wasn't his fault, sure, but she had a grudge against whoever's fault it had been. Whoever had decided that Ezra Dante had to be the first one born. Kaya hated them, because it seemed that his mother, at least, had favored him over her all their lives. As for old Alexander, he and Kaya had always been closer. Closer even than Ezra and his mother. But the one thing that seemed to bring them together was also killing her, and doing God knows what else to the until recently uninvited guest inside her. Ezra himself was a quiet boy. He mostly spent his time reading, writing, and studying in his room, taking, he supposed, after his mother, following in her footsteps of work ethic, but also, he supposed again, mimicking her isolation habits, opting however for creative writing and journalism instead of medicine. Ezra and Kaya were both now age 21, soon to be 22, and both supposed to be in college studying their respective subjects. Kaya had chosen to drop out of art school 2 days after the divorce was announced. This was after announcing, 2 months previous to the divorce being made official, that she was pregnant and wanted to keep the baby, also revealing that the father had no interest in being directly involved, but would agree to pay child support. That last part had made her father grunt, slumping on his recliner in the corner of the Hennessy Homestead, as it was known, a place that had also been designed by Grandma Megan and built by Grandpa Arthur. The Hennessy grandparents had apparently lived there for hundreds of years, as Grandpa Arthur would occasionally joke, but in all that apparent time they had been in residence. A certain corner of the prestige living space, the ceiling in particular, was infected with a strange kind of rot.
"Magic dirt," Grandpa called it. "Won't do you no harm as long as you keep away. And whatever you do, kids, don't look at it for too long. That dirt can get in your eyes."
The point is, in the months leading up to the divorce, Kaya had noticed her father's chair had suspiciously appeared directly underneath that infected corner. And on that night, when she had quite rightfully, while hiding behind her brother, her mother, and her grandparents, also explained that the baby's father's support was irrelevant to her. As long as she had the support of her family, that was all she needed to get through this. And at that, the twins' father had grunted again, not even deigning to look in his pregnant daughter's direction, stood up and made for the kitchen to refresh his drink. That moment had broken Kaya and enraged Ezra all over again, and was probably a large contributing factor to Amelia's frantic search for the door. Kaya swore from that moment on that she was done with the drugs, but this hadn't been the first time she had broken that promise. As a result of that moment and her collective chemical dependencies, mixed with a lifelong dash of schizophrenia, her pregnancy had been somewhat rocky and trippy. The gradual and sudden influx of pregnancy hormones had increased the potency and frequency of her visions exponentially, overriding her desire and need for self-preservation. Preservation not just for herself, but for the unborn child. 6 months in, she was back on the Class A's, being 3 times hospitalized for fear of a miscarriage or heart and liver failure. These hospitalizations then caused social services to take an unhealthy, or healthy depending on your perspective, interest in Kaya and her social situation. After learning about her mental illness, drug habits, family problems, and suicide attempts in her early teens, not to mention the one attempt during her first Braxton Hicks scare, which had led to hospitalization number 3, and to top it all, an absent father, the powers that be had seen fit to put the as-yet unborn child into the adoption system, officially declaring Kaya an unfit mother. Ezra hadn't been by his sister's side when that final declaration had been made, but he had felt it. And later, when he had come to visit her on the ward, he had felt it all over again. Ezra had sat at Kaya's hospital bedside countless times for countless different reasons, yet there was a look of resignation in her eyes, in her soul, that Ezra could see as clearly as he could see the scars on her arms, legs, and neck. Then, without blinking, she had finally made eye contact with her brother, having not spoken in almost an hour. She said, "I guess I just wanted to be closer to Mom." That was the moment that Ezra had demanded to his mother that Kaya be kept in this time around under observation. She had readily agreed, even switched to her ward to keep a personal eye on her. Amelia knew that there was a darkness within Kaya that Ezra understood. The same cold fire burned within his own heart. The want, the need to be not dead, just not here. Ezra nodded to himself in the car as he finished this thought. Not dead. Just not here.
"You okay there, bud?"
Ezra's father asked, nudging his son's shoulder. The drive from the Hennessy's former family home in Ithaca to the now former family cabin in Oswego County was just over 76 miles, about an hour and 40 minutes drive. At least half of that time had passed, and it was the first time either of them had spoken since they left. Ezra didn't much like when his father called him bud. "I'm fine," Ezra said, without turning his head. He could feel his father's eyes burning a hole in his left temple. He should be focusing on the road. He was probably high. "Kinda hot in here, huh?" Alex remarked. And in his peripheral vision, Ezra could see him fiddling with his shirt collar. Ezra shrugged. His father wound down the driver's side window 50% of the way, letting the outside air flood in, which caused Ezra's left-hand curtain of hair to blow the opposite way and catch his eye. "God!" Ezra exclaimed, louder than he intended. "Ever heard of air conditioning?" "I guess you're right," his father said, immediately sucking up. Then, of course, he retracted in his own way. In 3,
two, one. And, but there ain't nothing like fresh, clean air. There was an optimistic twang in his voice, suggesting he wanted his son to come around to his way of thinking. Asking you to do that would be like asking whether or not a newborn kitten could grasp the concept of Sweden. And there it was, that restless voice. It was at the bottom of a long, long list. But this one was different. It was new. Ezra, of course, didn't want to give his father the satisfaction, and so he merely muttered, "Whatever you say, Padre." "That rhymes," Alex sighed. "You know what I mean. It just ain't the same." Echoing his true feelings and seeing his opportunity to, Ezra hoped, plunge them both back into an only partially comfortable silence, Ezra replied, "Nothing will be the same. Not ever again." That one worked like a charm, like a serial killer's glove. Most of the rest of the journey was made in silence. They turned right on NY 104 East and continued on for around 12 miles, passing through the village of Hannibal. Ezra couldn't help but think of Hannibal Lecter when his eyes met the words on the sign, knowing that it was actually in tribute to a village hero. In his mind, he imagined what it would actually be like to kill something. Kill someone. It wasn't the first time he had had thoughts like this, but it was the first time that his imagined victim wasn't his college tutor, the snooty one with the gigantic chin, or those guys back in high school who had poured PVA glue in his comic book bag. A whole series of Hellblazer. Ruined. The memory of that was enough to make his blood boil as the car turned onto West First Street and then left onto Water Street. Was it a memory? Or had he just been in this car too long? He hoped it was a mixture of both as his temper had been getting away from him in recent weeks. Not least when his dad, when Alex, had chosen to walk out on the family home. One that, to be fair, wasn't really much occupied unless Kaya was hosting one of her parties. Regardless, it had just been after a full day of college for both the Hennessy children, and both of the Hennessy parents had worked nearly two full days in a row, so naturally, the atmosphere was somewhat heated. Especially due to Kaya's violent morning sickness that itself had no interest in keeping itself to the morning. Yet she had still been in college, working and attempting to distract herself from, well, herself. Alex had started once again complaining about the lack of contact during work hours and the mounting medical bills. Clearly, things weren't going so well at the office. As a hedge fund manager, or whatever the hell it was he did, he had to be on his new and improved PDA almost 24/7, keeping track of all the schedules. As a surgeon, however, Amelia spent most of her time off the radar. To be available for a phone call during open-heart surgery would be like having time to rustle up a salad whilst laying concrete. Alexander, however, didn't seem to understand that, despite his years being married to a surgeon. Or he did understand and was looking for an excuse to break the shackles and head to the nearest strip club. Amelia, it seemed, had also had enough. It seemed that 21 years was her limit. When Ezra thought about it, his parents' final fight as a legally binding married couple, in terms of context, wasn't really based on much. However, it was what was underneath the surface of it all that made the whole thing culminate into one massive explosion. Thank God, Grams and Grams weren't around for dinner that night, Ezra thought, now resting his head on the passenger side window. Most of what had followed was a blur. Of all the family members present that evening, Ezra had been the one who had needed to stay calm. Not in this case anyway, because of his temper. That night, it had been his sister who had needed a solid anchor, a rock to hold her down to earth, stop her getting lost, up there, in the clouded darkness. Their mother did a good job of containing herself. She wanted him to leave, sure, she was better off without him. But walking out on Kaya, weeks into her pregnancy, forcing her to choose between her mother and her father at the drop of a hat, and driving a seemingly unbreakable wedge between Ezra and his sister, that was unforgivable in Amelia's eyes. How dare he do this to them? And it was when Kaya broke down that their mother did the same. Alex went to the office, filing for divorce the following morning. Kaya, who had only left Ezra's field of view for a matter of minutes, overdosed later that evening and was rushed to hospital, accompanied by her mother, who was also on her way back to work. After the hospital, Ezra had demanded to be dropped off at his grandparents' house to cool off. For the pregnancy's duration, Ezra stayed, calling Kaya daily, refusing to leave except to see his sister.
knowing that he was on a level ground being with his grandparents. They knew what was best, after all. It took a total of many days for Ezra's father to wear him down. "Come on, we'll head up north for a few days. It'll be great. Just you and me." Ezra had slammed the door in his face the first time he had asked. He had turned up the day after he had walked out of the house stinking of booze and pretty much coughing up stripper glitter. "Going to the office. Sure you were. A celebration, no doubt, while his daughter lay dying in a hospital bed. From use of drugs she no doubt obtained from one of her father's many stashes that he had once drunkenly revealed to her in confidence on yet another endless night 2 years before. It had made him so angry that he wanted to pounce on Alexander and throttle him to the ground. Perhaps there was enough glitter left in there to clog his airways. Maybe he'll go into shock, perhaps have a heart attack. These thoughts were intrusive, but not unwelcome. Again, Ezra wasn't sure if he was merely reliving memories as he rested his eyes in the Explorer, as it passed presently through Fruit Valley, as it was known, or whether those feelings were fresh. "Fresh out of darkness, the mist descends," Ezra muttered, his eyes still closed. And he didn't quite notice that the voice he spoke, no, sang those words in, didn't seem to belong to him. "That's because they don't. Something's wrong. Someone else is in here. Someone else is in here somewhere, Ezra, and I don't like it." "What was that?" The sound of his father's voice startled him. Ezra shook his head, his eyes shooting open. "Nothing. Nothing. Are we..." He struggled to find his words. "Are we nearly there?" "Just about, yeah. You sure you're okay?" This time there seemed to be genuine concern in his voice. Ezra had always been very sensitive to the frequencies of people's voices, not least that of those close to him. His father's latest question had been in a low frequency, not soft, but low, understated. Alex was the kind of man who could only show emotion in an understated fashion. It was the tone he used when he was actually being serious, when he was actually worried, when he actually cared. It was a frequency that Ezra responded to positively, and he did, though inwardly. On the outside, he chose to shrug it off. "Yeah, I'm fine. All good. Just not been sleeping much." "You and me both, kid. I'm 21 years old, Dad. I'm not a kid anymore." "I don't doubt that. You've been the one keeping me down to earth. I'm proud of the man you've become, even if you do write a load of shit sometimes." Ignoring the professional jab he was all too used to, Ezra moved the subject away from himself. "What about Kaya? I'm proud of her too. Of course I am." "He's lying. He's lying to you, and he's lying about her." "She's not going back to college, you know," Ezra said. "Not after this." "I know. And do you care?" "She's gonna get into trouble, Dad. Mom isn't there enough to make sure she doesn't make the wrong kind of impulsive decisions, ward or no ward. You know what Kaya's like. And Mom, she cares more about her operating table than she does about her goddamn daughter." "She's a big girl," Alex said, flatly. "Besides, I did ask if she wanted to come to the cabin with us, didn't I?" "I think trying to plan a weekend getaway while your schizophrenic daughter is trying to process the divorce of her parents in the middle of a nervous breakdown in a hospital from an overdose that puts her into labor, giving birth to a child she will never get to raise, probably never get to see, I think..." Ezra paused and took a deep breath. That's a little bit of a stretch. Such a stretch that Reed Richards would have problems reaching it." "Don't say that," Alex said, shooting him a look. "You know I don't like that word. Schizophrenic. I sure as hell can't spell it." Ezra's anger was bubbling again. It pulsated through him like a dying star. Sweat began to form on his pale forehead. "You don't just not like the word, you deny it even exists. She's a mess, Dad. And you've made it worse. She's gonna die because of you." Ezra was glad that he kept the last dig to himself. "You watch your mouth, boy. Don't be talking to me like that." And there it was, the shift in tone, the one that made Ezra want to snap and force his father to lose control of the goddamn car. Maybe a journey through the fucking windscreen would knock some sense into this asshole. But Ezra resisted the temptation. He just said nothing. Ezra's internal thoughts and feelings, however, spoke much louder than he would ever know. Just then he remembered the other reason why he decided to come to the lake house. Other than the reasons he had already been over thus far in his own mind. The smiling blood.
For some reason, his brain had decided to call it that. His brain loved to title specific life moments. The smiling blood that had sent him running to the door, ahead of the doorbell ringing to find his father on the doorstep, with a brief explanation to his granddad Arthur, and a few minutes to pack the essentials, he had walked out of his safe place into the outside world. Sure, he knew that the place he was heading to was another safe place, and that was what spurred him forward to the car despite the hesitation in his mind, telling him that the journey wouldn't be worth the elation of destination. But he had kept walking. The smiling blood had made it so. What was the smiling blood? Imagine seeing someone you love, or perhaps someone you hate, smile wide and true, and then imagine seeing their teeth start to break and their gums start to bleed, run down their reddening, now cracking lips, and drip down onto whatever surface may lie below. In this case, Ezra's grandmother Megan's cream carpet. Ezra saw his grandmother smile and then begin to bleed. It was just him who saw it, mind you. His grandma Megan didn't even notice, being busy herself rewiring one of her many sewing machines, because it wasn't really happening, and Ezra knew that. It was what was going to happen. The smiling blood itself was just a hallucination. There was no blood, no newly ruined carpet. Those, albeit vivid details, were all in his mind. However, that was not the problem. The problem came in the form of what the hallucination signified, because whenever the smiling blood appeared, the person bleeding was soon to meet their death. In the past, whether it be a close friend with an as yet undiagnosed medical condition, or a random person on the street having a drink outside a restaurant that then gets stabbed to death while staggering home to his wife and children, Ezra's hallucinations may not have technically been real in the eyes of all those doctors who had looked at his head. And sure, maybe they weren't real, but that did not, repeat, did not make them any less right. He finished these thoughts with his eyes scanning the road as the car drove on. And sure enough, there she was, standing at the roadside. Although the car passed quickly, Ezra knew that it was her. The purple cardigan that was his grandma Megan's pride and joy was unmistakable. Sure, she wasn't really there. It was just his brain reminding him what he was running away from. But once again, his brain was right. And his brain was cruel. No. He was right, and he was cruel, because he had run away. He had told Granddad Arthur what he saw. He had nodded in understanding and trepidation, but had given his grandson a comforting hug before letting him go to clear his head. It won't be like the other, son. It'll take longer for her. Much longer. You can trust me on that. Ezra didn't know whether that was a good thing or a terrible one. But the memory of his granddad's words was enough for him to settle back and rest his wearied eyes for the remainder of the journey. They arrived at the cabin shortly after 3:30 p.m., and around 3:45 it began to rain, a somewhat unsteady fall of rain, cold and bitter, unexpected. It vomited down from a grey, swirling sky, pelting the roof and stiffly limp leaves around the house. Ezra had always liked the rain. His sleep disturbances, the really bad ones anyway, had begun at the age of 4, and rain seemed to be the only thing that could get Ezra to drift off again. The sound of the rain coming into contact with the log roof had always been soothing to his ear. He hoped, as he entered the house, scuffing his feet, his case dragging behind him, that it would work when he attempted to sleep tonight. Hope, scoffed the voice in his head, the mocking one, the new one, the one that had started talking to him right around the time he had arrived at his grandparents a few months before. Boring. Who needs hope when you have me? Shut up, Ezra muttered, immediately making for the spiral staircase in front of him. He could hear his father unpacking the car behind. He did not offer his help, nor did he unpack his own suitcase when he arrived in the room that belonged to him. He simply sat at his desk, thinking, waiting. Usually, when his mind was troubled, he could sit at his desk with a pen and paper, word processor, or even his grandmother's old typewriter that lived in Ezra's lakehouse bedroom, and write down his feelings. It was something his grandmother particularly had always encouraged him to do. It was something that he did. I mean, he was hoping to be a journalist someday, for Christ's sake. Creative writing major or no. All you could see when you looked around the room were newspaper clippings of different articles of interest. And books. Lots and lots of books. piled on shelves, bookcases, some giant Jenga projects spanning from floor to ceiling, that themselves were stuffed with various manuscript ideas, character profiles, and crude disproportional character portraits, and half-finished diaries. There were also some certificates he had been awarded back in high school for creative writing competitions, none that he was particularly proud of, but mostly articles he had written for the school paper. Writing was all he could do, at least that's what he told himself. His grandparents said he was gifted, that he and Kaya were both gifted in their own ways. Kaya herself displayed a talent for art and sport, a beautiful dancer, almost as fast as a speeding bullet, as their father used to say. Far superior to her brother in physical ability, sometimes Kaya called Ezra the rake, or more recently, the mop. The upturned mop that leans on walls and doors and listens, as she had once put it, when she had spied him people watching in a hospital waiting room, leaning against one of the ward's connecting doors, holding it open for all the passers-by, his wavy, shoulder-length black hair hiding his face from view, as if he believed that he was invisible. What had struck Kaya as odd was that to them, he was invisible. They seemed to just walk straight by him, caught up in their own lives, paying no attention to this creature performing a service of convenience. Ezra saw them, of course, all of them, however briefly. It seemed that, on that day, in the waiting room, the only one who could see Ezra was his sister, as if he only existed from Kaya's perspective alone. But she saw him see them. She knew he could see exactly where all of those people had come from, where they were going, and whether or not they were going anywhere at all. Ezra was definitely the more sedate of the Hennessy children, outwardly sedate anyway, highly meditative, whereas his sister just couldn't sit still. That was Ezra's main worry. His eyes moved to his wall of family photographs that sat above his desk, then back to his 19th century typewriter, Kaya's adaptable impulsivity. Ezra attempted to focus on his intended task, or maybe just on the present moment, a college assignment that wouldn't be due for a while now, since he had chosen to take up his tutor's offer of time off. 3,000 words on the concept of free will, in the form of a fictional story. Ezra grimaced. It wasn't something he particularly wanted to delve into. Not at the moment, anyway. His thoughts dwelled on his sister's welfare. The last couple of weeks had been hard. Hard for everyone, but none more than Kaya. It wasn't her fault. She couldn't control what she heard, what she saw. Often she would sketch out her hallucinations, and would only ever show them to Ezra. Her brother was the only one she trusted, despite their rivalry as far as their mother was concerned. Kaya knew that Ezra was the only other person in the world who could understand. He saw what she saw. They were twins, and so that was the way of things. There was, however, one key difference. Ezra had found a way to channel what he heard and saw, to convert it, reconstruct it into other useful things like stories and characters. He had been doing that for as long as he could remember. His grandma taught him how. Taught them both how. Though Kaya's illness, if you were talking to their father, or gift, if you were talking to their grandparents, was far more acute than his own. And so, her creative responses, as their grandparents called them, were far more erratic and far less structured than Ezra's, even with regular practice. Despite the fact that they were both writing and speaking eloquently from age 3, Ezra had always been the hyper-focused one, as opposed to the divergent thinker that his sister would grow up to become, possessing a natural affinity for psychedelic art, primarily using charcoal as a baseline for most of her pieces. Ezra's sister could bring any landscape or individual to life in ways that were both equally impressive and disturbing. Watching them almost move in front of his eyes was one thing. Watching and almost hearing them scream as she tore them to shreds in the midst of a dissociative episode, erasing them from existence entirely, that was something else. He could feel them bleed. As a result of the twins' respective talents, Ezra flew through education. Kaya wasn't quite so lucky. Not quite so lucky at all. And the divorce was just the icing on the cake. And it tastes vile, deleting the mind along with the years. Ezra knew that Kaya had tried hard to hide the envy. But he could see it. Whenever Ezra would finish an article, or a story, or even a character profile, he would see it. That spark of sadness and longing, if not for a more ordered mind, then perhaps maybe just a quieter one. Ezra hung his head. The guilt was weighing heavily on him. So much he thought he might sink to the floor. He should be with his sister, not his father. But he just needed time. He decided it was time to try and rest. He laid himself down gently and stared up to the ceiling.
"Free will," said the mocking voice. "My voice. What will you do with it?" "What indeed?" Ezra said aloud before closing his eyes. End of part one.
If you're a podcast clown like I am, you must have dreamed about starting your own. Let me tell you, my dreadful darlings, it's never easy, but it's one of the best decisions I ever made. It was either that or waste away in my own subjective ascendance. Of course, it can be more than just a little overwhelming to know how to get started. Buzzsprout can help you launch your podcast professionally and in style, linking you with all of the major podcasting platforms such as Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and much, much more. Join us up in the buzzing, sprouting podcast cloud to breathe in the renowned analytical sound of the accurate analysis and promotion tools provided. Follow the link in the show notes below to start your journey and receive a $20 Amazon gift card. We're waiting for you. Buzzsprout, the best and excitingly prettiest way to start a podcast.